So it's James chapter 4 is where we're at, and we've been studying this with the idea that the Epistle of James presents a number of issues that challenge faith, and these issues are common to all, and success is achieved when faith is employed. It is as though James is asking, how is your faith? And when it comes to some particular issue. So it's unlikely that any of us face all these things, but we will certainly face some. Now tonight, we're looking at James chapter 4, verse 6, the latter part of verse 6 through verse 10. The last time I mentioned that, actually verse 6 was kind of transitional. It could go, either way, so I just took half of it last time, half of it this time. But in James chapter 4, verses 1 through 6, the first part of verse 6, it's about how is your faith when it comes to personal desires. And he's discussing how personal desires often can cause problems, major and minor problems. And I believe that the part we're looking at tonight, though, is the solution, one of the possible solutions our personal desires and getting a hold of them and having the good control of them that we should. And it also works for other matters as well. Now let me point something out here. We'll read these passages in just a few moments. But actually what it is how is your faith when it comes to being near to God? And I think obviously, you know, if you're near to God or you're coming near to God, faith has got, you know, a large part to play in this. But I think as a personal observation here, considering back what starting in verse 1 and down through verse 10, I think to myself that James not only points out the problem, you know, that might be the easy part of it, to point out the problem. But then he offers a solution. So he addresses the issue in verses 1 through 6, the first part, and then at the latter part, of verse 6 through verse 10, here's the solution. And I really think that that's what ought to be done every time. Anybody can just say, well, this isn't what it should be, or this is wrong, or anything like that. Anybody can do that, and lots of people do. But then when you ask for some kind of a solution or an answer to a problem, that's where sometimes there's nothing that's given because, well, I don't know what the solution is. I just know that this is not what it should be or is wrong or whatever the case is. But I think that when we address something, you know, we ought to point out not just what's wrong, we'll point out what's right. I think that's what Jesus did, didn't he? Well, I mean, when he would confront the scribes and the Pharisees or anybody like that, and he would point out what their problems were, he would immediately offer a solution to this and say, this is the way it should be. And I think that we ought to do likewise. The letters that are written to churches in the New Testament and churches that had problems. I mean, look at the letter to the Corinthians. They had lots of problems. And when Paul was addressing these problems, you know, he's addressing the problem of division at the very beginning. And he says, look how you're all divided up. And some of you are claiming to be followers of Paul and some followers of Cephas and some even of Christ. And he says, that's not how it ought to be. You're all saying the different things. And he says, I wish that you're all speaking the same thing. And then goes from there to point out, you know, what ought to be said. So that's how we ought to be doing this. If we tell someone, for example, that denominationalism is wrong, we ought to be able to tell them what's right. We'll be able to point it out to them. And if we tell someone, for example, well, now, instrumental music, you know, that's not how to go with this. And we ought to be able to tell them what's right. And to explain why it's right. So, as with much of this, and in James, we'll see a lot of similarity to other things that we've looked at so far. But let's we'll read all of verse 6 and down to verse 10. He gives a greater grace, therefore it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit, therefore, to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and He will exalt you. As with much of what we've seen so far in James, there's a comparison here, I think, in verse 6. And there's the break in here, because the first part he gives a greater grace. That really refers to what came on here beforehand. And then the rest of it is kind of transitional. It could go either way, about the God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And the comparison that you see here is of a proud, vain person. That's the one earlier here, who's consumed with receiving their personal desires. They want it their way, they want it a certain way, and they just insist on this. So it's from that to over here to being someone who has a desire to humbly seek the will of God. And that's quite a difference between the two. And then also His grace is available and it's abundant for one who draws near to God. And that's what we're considering tonight. So how is your faith when it comes to being near to God? I would imagine that there are lots of people that want to be near to God, or perhaps think that they're near to God. Now, the reality of this, what it takes to be near to God, maybe more than some people want to do, and the fact that some people think that they're near to God, it might not be necessarily the case. A person could be, you know, deceived in any number of ways of thinking that. So as we go through this, we want to see how important it is and how this works out, you know, about being near to God. The very first thing that he brings up here is we are to submit to God. I think this thing's got a stuck button. Okay. It's to submit to God. Now, the idea of the word submit here, it means to subject oneself. You can read lots of definitions. This is one of them that comes from Thayer. I'll use Thayer, Strong, Vine. I'll use those when I want definitions of words that are used in the original language. And to subject oneself. And we understand what that is, you know, submission. And it really means with the idea of being obedient. Submission, you know. Animals are trained to be in submission to their master. And so they do what the master commands them to do. Now they do it, you know, by rote and association, other things like that. But we understand the idea of this. And now here's the thing. It's the opposite of resist. You see here where he says submit to God and resist the devil. So that's kind of a comparison in and of itself, isn't it? When you stop and think about it, they're the opposite. So if you resist, you don't subject oneself, is the idea there. And just think about how simple this is. Now, you submit to God, you resist the devil. Now, the result of this is the devil will flee from you. I think there's evidence of that in the temptation of Jesus, isn't there? Because he did what? Well, here comes the devil with these temptations. He resists the devil. He submits to God because he says, you know, this is what's written. I've got to go with this. You know, and Satan, the whole idea of temptations, any temptation of Satan, not just with Jesus, but with you and I, the temptation is to do something that Satan wants you to do or do the opposite of what God says needs to be done. There's where the temptation is. To make something that's wrong look right. Or to make something that's wrong seem attractive, you know, and lure somebody in on the basis of that. And it's based on deception. But you can submit, he says here in James, and you can resist. It's easy. Sure. And what happened after Jesus resisted the devil? Well, he left him, didn't he? Now, it doesn't mean he left him permanently. And if we resist the devil, it doesn't mean he'll leave us permanently. But we would have at least for the moment an upper hand on the situation. But think about that. While that's so simple to understand, easy to understand, is that really what's happening? How's our faith when it comes to this? Is it really that we're submitting to God and resisting the devil? Now, you and I know what goes on out here in the world, don't we? Is that what's going on out there in the world? People are submitting to God and they're resisting the devil? You know what's really going on in the world? There are people out there that are submitting to the devil and they're resisting God. I had this person not too long ago, and I can remember living in the neighborhood with the family. I was friends with the boy. He was quite a bit younger than me, but he was a big boy, so he got to play with the older kids. And he could pretty well hold his own up to a point. And they went to the little church that was just over there, kind of a block away from us. They used to invite me. I'd go every once in a while. I wasn't really crazy about it. But, you know, I kind of thought to myself, living there, I thought, well, they're kind of a religious people and so on. And then the kids got older, and that wasn't the case with the kids. And, they didn't darken the door of a church building anymore. And I'm sure they had reasons. They were different reasons. And the daughter, who was about my age, one time explained her reason. Well, I was just drugged to church all the time, made to go. And went on and on and on, and how this was just some terrible thing. And I thought to myself, and then you can read the things that she does in her lifestyle, and I thought, well, I thought of them when I thinking about this, about submitting to the devil and resisting God. You know, there are people that are really and truly resisting God, aren't they? And they may not know that they're actually submitting to the devil. But if you resist God, that's exactly what's the other choice? What is there? Is there a third position in here where you're really neither one, you're kind of neutral? And maybe there's people that think, oh yeah, that's really what it is. Well, I'm neutral. Well, you know, no, there's no third point. You know, you serve one master or the other. You submit to God, you resist the devil. Or you submit to the devil and you resist God. There you go. But we don't think about that other side of this, see. We don't think about the submitting to the devil and resisting God. We don't like to. It makes us uncomfortable. Because you know what? I might fit in that. So, you know, we kind of like to take a step back from that. And really the idea of submitting to God, I think when he says this to the individuals here, this kind of presupposes their knowledge of God's will. In 1 John chapter 2 and verse 21, he says, I have not written to you because you do not know the truth, but because you do know it, and because no lie is of the truth. So all the things he was saying in there, probably not to so much educate them in the truth, but that they know the truth, and I'm bringing these things up to get you to realize that they are there, and you know that they're there, you'll look, you'll find there, and what you'll be doing them. That's the point. So back here, when he tells them, you know, that you need to submit to God and resist the devil, it's not to educate them. It's kind of stir them up to be busy about the work that they ought to be doing. How's your faith when it comes to drawing near to God? Are you submitting to the devil? Are you resisting God? Or is it the other way, the right way? How is your faith when it comes to drawing near to God? And now the example for us of drawing near to God, go to the book of John. I'm going to show you some passages that I've always liked on this, and it concerns Jesus and the way he said certain things. But I want us to realize that when it comes to submission to God, our example is with Christ in submission to God, to the will of God. John chapter 4 and verse 34, Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. We all know what food means. The old translation has meat, but it means food. Food is what keeps us going, keeps us alive. It's what sustains us. And Jesus is saying here that his food is to do the will of God. That's what keeps him going. That's what sustains him. Do we have that kind of an idea that doing the will of God is that important? Without doing the will of God, I'm no more. I will
I will cease to exist. You know, that kind of an idea.
And then John chapter 8, we would notice another one there in John chapter 8, verse 29, where Jesus is saying, "And he who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone." Now watch this part. "For I always do the things that are pleasing to him." I'd say that we can say that about Jesus without equivocation. He always did the things that pleases him. And really that's what we strive for. And I hope that we probably can recognize that there are times when maybe we don't get always do the things that please him. But then at the same time, there are occasions when we do the things that please him. I remember, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, somewhere, something along that line, I was listening to an invitation on Wednesday night someone else was doing, and got to talking about how, you know, we're unworthy and how we fail at times. All right, point well taken. I'm not going to disagree with that. But this young man went on in this and on and on and on that point to the extent I began to wonder if we ever do anything right. Now, I know that there's a whole doctrine, a whole part of Calvinism that teaches that. We don't do anything right. We can't do anything right. We could try day and night, every day, every night. We'd never do anything right. And then their answer to that is, well, we just rely on Jesus who does it all. I guess that means we can't do anything right. Don't worry about it. Don't even try. Jesus will do it for you. Where's this at in the Scriptures, you know? I don't see it. You know, Jesus did the Father's will. He did things that pleased him. He's supposed to be an example for us. Is he an example for us in something that we cannot do, that's impossible for us to do? I don't think so. I think on occasions, we mess up. We don't do what we're supposed to do. But I think that there's also occasions where we do the right things. I toyed around with the idea for a sermon, and I thought the title ought to be, "Does Anybody Do the Right Thing Anymore?" But then I thought, that's so broad a subject, I just kind of put over in that file that says, maybe later sometime, I'll pass that on to Daniel and Sean, let them worry about it. But I think that we do that. And of course, the passage up there, I think that's the classic, and maybe you thought of it, Luke chapter 22, verse 42. In the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus is praying and he says, "Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." And I think there it is right there. You know, he's not out here doing his own will. He's doing the Father's will. And the amazing thing is that the Father's will is actually his will. The Father's will becomes his will. And the Father's will ought to become our will as well. That's really the goal. That's what we're really striving for. And all of this, if we'll submit to God, it allows for success. 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5, starting in verse 5, down through 11. "You younger men, likewise, be subject to your elders. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. For God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble." That's what was said back in James, wasn't it? It's something that's taken actually from Proverbs chapter 3. But anyway. "Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time." That's said in James also. "Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour." And then he says something that's also in James. "Resist him. Firm in your faith." How is your faith? Oh, that'll help you to resist the devil as you draw near to God. Right. "Knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world." So it's not that the whole load of everything's been dumped on you and you alone. No, other people suffer. "After you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. It's like we're talking about this morning. You know, always at your side. Always there for help. Someplace you can go for refuge. And we can do that. And God's given His Word for instruction to help us, to assist us, to draw near to God, be able to resist the devil, etc., etc. Now, the nuts and bolts of this and how to submit, it starts off there in James by saying, well, you draw near to God. That's an easy thing to say, and we pointed that out just a few moments ago. But draw near to God, and then he says, and he will draw near to you. So drawing near to God is the same thing as submitting to God's will up there in verse 7. There's no difference in that. It's just a different way of saying the same thing. But what you see here in verse 8 is to draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. So what do you see? Well, we see a two-way street here, don't we? We see reciprocal action taking place here. And it's not only just that, but then it goes on to say, here's something that's necessary. To cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. So there's some cleansing and purification that's required. Not optional. It's required. I think to myself that this may be drawn from something in the Old Testament. Now, there's lots that's said on this, but we're just going to look at one place. It's in Exodus chapter 30. So you might turn back there, and we'll just look at two or three verses. Now, this is the part of Exodus where after the giving of the law, there's lots of other instructions that come along that are connected with that law. And it's about the Old Testament servants in the tabernacle and then later the temple. This is what one of the many things that they were supposed to do would be the priests, the high priests, and the other priests. Look at verse 19. Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet from it. When they enter the tent of meeting, they shall wash with water so that they will not die. Or when they approach the altar to minister by offering up in smoke a fire sacrifice to the Lord, they will wash their hands and their feet so that they will not die. It shall be a perpetual statute for them, for Aaron and his descendants throughout their generations. Well, why were they doing that? Well, that was part of the cleansing and the purification process. And they were supposed to do this, you know, before they even went into the tabernacle or did anything. That was something that was required. If you don't do that, you'll die. I take that to mean that God would just, you know, he pulled something like with Nadab and Abihu. And it was something that could be so easily done. It wasn't a big deal. There wasn't some kind of a 2 or 3 day ritual about washing your hands and your feet. But you were to do that because where you would be walking was holy ground, and what you would be touching would be holy things. So you cleanse and you purify, you know, your hands and your feet in these cases. And then the counterpart to this, you go to Hebrews chapter 9. There's a counterpart to this because there's cleansing and purification in the New Testament mentioned as well. Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 14. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. So there's a cleansing that takes place there. Now our problem's not with our hands and our feet. Our problem would be with sin. And so there's a cleansing by the blood of Christ from sin. And then the purifying, well, you go to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 22. Which says, since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. You've purified your souls. You've done what's necessary to have sins forgiven, taken away. They washed their hands and their feet in the Old Testament. Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins. So if you wash away the sins, wouldn't you be cleansed and purified? get that out of the way, and then service to God is something that's possible. And you know, and sins are said to be forgiven. Jesus said that when instituting Lord's Supper, that the cup, the fruit of the vine, represented His blood, which was shed for many for the remission or forgiveness of sins, and baptism is for the remission or forgiveness of sins. So we see it's the idea of sins being forgiven in the New Testament. And here's another thing. In verse 9, James chapter 4, verse 9. Now, I'll tell you what, there was a long time this verse gave me a problem. I just couldn't figure out, you know, what's it talking about? How does this fit in? And if you think about this in a literal, physical way, yeah, there's a problem there. But really, I think what it's talking about relates to spiritual matters, if you will. And you know, it's connected back up here in verse 8. You see, it talks about the double-minded. Now, something's got to be done about the double mind. It's got to be eliminated. And Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, He's speaking about loyalty there. He says, "No one can serve two masters. You will either love the one and hate the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, God and riches or money." We understand perfectly, you know, what He's talking about. You can't serve two masters. You cannot do that. That's just impossible. I've seen these, you know, things and so on, where, you know, people try to run things by committee. It never works that well, you know. Too many masters. What's the old saying we have about too many cooks? Too many cooks spoil the broth, I think's the original wording of that. We just need one. We just need one master. Listen to that. That master, of course, would be Jesus. So this goes along with what's being said, you know, about drawing near to God, submitting to God, resisting the devil, all these kinds of things. So we've got to eliminate that double mind. We've got to work at this. That can sneak in there so easy. Easier than perhaps what we think. And then that, and everything that's been said, when you get over here to verse 9, I really think, you know, it's talking about in verse 9, a reversal of life. Now, let me explain what we're talking about here. We're talking about a reversal of life that indicates repentance. Now, notice what it says here, that you're to be miserable and mourn and weep. Does that just mean, you know, that you're just supposed to be somebody who's just sad all the time? You know, you remember that little character? I like this little guy in Little Abner. Remember him? He's dressed in black and he had on this kind of a ratty looking hat. And his name was Joe. I can get that far out of it. And then the last part of his name, he really needed to buy a vowel. And you just can't pronounce it. But he was well known in the Little Abner universe. And he walked around and he had his own private rain cloud over him all the time. It rained on him all the time. And every once in a while, to kind of spice things up, lightning would come out of that rain cloud and it only hit him. Now, the point is that this was a miserable man. And he was miserable all the time. It was just a life of constant misery. Is that what this is saying here? We're supposed to be like old Joe out of Little Abner. Now, we know that it's not. Because we know there are other passages that talk a great deal about joy, right? You can't be both. You can't be miserable and joyful at the same time. So it doesn't mean that. And then you see, let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. Well, there's a reversal. But it seems like, you look at that and you think, that's kind of going the wrong way, isn't it? Shouldn't it be mourning turned to laughter? And shouldn't it be gloom turned to joy? Well, we think, yeah, that's what it ought to be. But that's not what it says. So what's it talking about here? I think it's talking about spiritual matters. I really do. I think it's the idea that, you know how it says in Hebrews in reference to Moses and talking about Moses' upbringing. You know, Moses was treated as the son of Pharaoh. He had it made, didn't he? He had everything was right there at his beck and call, you know, whatever. Had everything. But then it goes on to tell us that he gave that up. And he gave that up to go with the children of Israel. But you know, the interesting thing of this is it gave up the pleasures of sin for a season, didn't it? That's the old translation. There's pleasure in sin. Yeah, there is. And there are people that are having a big time in their sin. They're not resisting the devil. They're right into it, you know. They're out there and they're grabbing for all the gusto and all those other things. And we see this. Don't think that there's not some pleasure in sin. Satan offered Jesus, you know, some things if he would follow him. Well, there'd be pleasure in those things. To be an important person, be powerful. And look at that fruit on that tree there, Eve. She took of that fruit and ate of it, didn't she? Does it say anywhere in there that it just tasted terrible? No, it doesn't. It doesn't say it tasted good either. But now she took of it and gave it and ate and gave to her husband. She didn't tell him, oh, don't eat this. You know, it tastes just something terrible. Maybe if it tasted terrible, it helped. Oh, no, she saw that it was good for food. She saw that. Now, I think what this is talking about here is that all of that grabbing for the gusto and all of that being involved in sin and all that pleasure again, you know what you ought to do? You ought to be sorry about it. You ought to let all that laughter with the good time be turned into sorrow. You ought to mourn over these things rather than celebrate them. We've already seen plenty of things in the last few years about the celebration of sin all over the world. It's just sometimes it's just shocking, just overwhelming. But that's what goes on. Now, when you do that, and you've got this, you know, reversal of life, the remorse over what you've done, what you've been doing, and then you want to make a change. Godly sorrow brings repentance, it says there in 2 Corinthians 7, verse 10. And I think that's what this is here. I think the gloom and the mourning and all that and the misery and the weeping is the remorse, the godly sorrow. And if that's true, if that's genuine, that's going to bring repentance. And that's the good thing. And that would go along with the rest of the context. That double-mindedness, we're getting that out of there. We've got a mind toward God. We're going to draw near to God now. Get away from that stuff. We're going to resist the devil now and submit ourselves to the will of God. That works in there perfectly when you look at it in that sense. And then finally, there's the reward of the humble. In verse 10, humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and He will exalt you. One of the things about this, it says, you do this now in the presence of the Lord. I think this goes along with what you find in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 6. We're speaking to servants or slaves and telling them, you know, how they ought to be conducting themselves. He says, not by the way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. And then you could also even add verse 7, with good will render services to the Lord and not to men. So this is something that you do that's not just in the sight of the men. You know, well, yeah, you ought to do it then, and that obviously that's going to happen. But more so, should you do this when others aren't watching? You know, I think it's that old idea about integrity or character. Here's what you do when people are watching. Well, what are you doing when they're not watching? Are you someone different? You know, there's lots of evidence that, you know, that is really the case. Sure. But we find out that here, the reward of the humble is to be in the sight of God, not man. That's what's important. And there are examples, aren't there, of those who may have been involved in things and they made changes. Or maybe there were those that just realized that they were not what they should be and they hoped for more. You want a couple of examples? How about the prodigal son? What does it say? It says he came to himself. He had that moment when he realized, well, look where I'm at. And all the problems I have, all the wounds that I bear are self-inflicted. He came to himself and he said, I will go to my father and I will tell him, I'm not worthy to be called your son. That's what he said. And you follow along in the narrative and you find out he gets back to where his father's at. And his father sees him coming and rushes to him and throws his arm around. And you know what the son did then? He sees that the father's willing to accept him. Why, he just takes advantage of the situation. Decides, well, I've got Dad snowballed. I'll just get everything I can. Well, he'd already done that. Maybe he thought he could do it again. No, that's not what happened. That's what a lot of people might do. No, we find out that he tells his father exactly what he determined earlier to tell him. I've sinned against you and against God. And I'm not worthy to be called your son. That takes a lot of humility to do all that. And then there's another one in Luke chapter 18. It's a contrast there, isn't it, between the Pharisee and the publican. You remember how that goes? And the Pharisee and how I've always had this desire. If I'd have been there, I'd think to myself, well, you know, you need to stick a pin in that guy and let a little bit of the air out of him. You know, one of those things. But he's really full of himself. That's all he talked about was himself. But then there's this publican. And even after being put down by the Pharisee, you know, I'm glad I'm not like that guy over there. Can you imagine? But even after that, you find the publican there in Luke chapter 18, verses 13 and 14. Tax collector standing some distance away was even unwilling to lift his eyes to heaven and was beating his breast saying, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. I tell you, this man went to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Kind of what's being said over there in James. And, you know, these examples now of the prodigal son and the publican, and think what you will about all of them. Mistakes? Make a mistake. You know, a publican was someone who really thrived in his business by extorting more taxes than were owed, as well as other things. So there's the deceit, there's the lying, there's the, you know, just the everything connected with that. They have lots of mistakes there. But you know what the interesting thing is here? They humbled themselves. And they humbled themselves, and we find out in both cases they were received. And so will the humble be lifted up. The old translation doesn't have exalted. It's got lifted up. Now, we'll be lifted up. We'll be lifted up to a position where we'd be honored, not by the world, but we'd be honored by God and recognized and received by God. And that's the important thing. And what a contrast it is to start out in James 4 with those who are so full of their personal desires, and it's caused problems and fighting and quarrels and conflicts, and get down here and, well, you ought to give all that up. You ought to humble yourself in the sight of the Lord. That's more important than being right in some quarrel or conflict or controversy or anything like that. Being recognized, exalted, lifted up by God. And a humble person can also be right in conflicts and quarrels and other things like that. So it's all something for us to think about. It was good to bring up the point. It's good to consider this. And how is our faith when it comes about drawing near to God? It's something that we all ought to be desiring to do, you know, no matter the effort that it takes. Not only should we submit to God, but we ought to remain in submission to Him. Take your songbook, certain songs have been selected. We'd be happy to help anyone become in subjection, in submission to God tonight by obeying the gospel of Christ. And if you've done that and perhaps fallen by the wayside, we'd be happy to pray with you and for you. Whatever the case might be, if you're subject to the gospel invitation, now's the time. Why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.